So, my name's Phil Spark. I'm the president of Northern Inland Council for the Environment. And I'm also an ecologist that I've been working in the Northwest for 18 years. I have my own small consultancy business and I've been a farmer for all my life. So, that's my background.
What brings you to Maules Creek, Phil?
Well, we got involved in the campaign to try and save Laird Forest. In 2006, when Boggabri Coal first got kicked off, we opposed the approval of that mine back in that era. And yeah, at that stage, it didn't look like being a really big mine or a big impact. And we had a lot of other things happening, so we didn't pursue it as strongly as we probably should have. But then when the new proposal for the much larger Maules Creek, when the extension of Boggabri kicked off, we knew that it was a very significant impact and it was something that we just had to make a priority. So, yeah, we got involved with the Maules Creek community to provide assistance because we had been involved in some other environmental actions. So the Maules Creek community were largely farmers and they needed some help, so we joined in with them.
You're an ecologist. What is it about the Laird State Forest that makes it so special?
Well, it's a big remnant, and it's a big remnant in an agricultural landscape. So all the area around Laird is largely farming country, and there's a bit of grazing as well, but largely farming country. So that's the Liverpool Plains. It's a fertile plain that joins on the Namoi River floodplain. And yeah, Laird sort of pops up on that floodplain, and to the east there's the Nandiwar Range, Kapiti National Park, and to the west is the Pilliga. So this Laird sort of juts up in the middle of the plain. It's a very important refuge for species dispersing from the Liverpool over to the Pilliga. So that's one of its landscape significances. The other real significant thing about it is that it's has a large area of white box woodland which is critically endangered. So the original determination of that community, or the nomination for that community to be listed as critically endangered, they identified that there was down to 0.1% of it left, so a thousandth of its original extent in good condition. Now the mines are going to clear 1,100 hectares of some of the best white box woodland that's left. So white box woodland's pretty much restricted to travelling stock routes and crown lands and cemeteries and forests like this. So it's a big remnant that's 7,000 hectares. It's really significant, and that white box woodland is conserving, we know, 28 threatened species, and there's likely to be probably 30 threatened species occur within that forest. So the huge number of threatened species plus the critically endangered ecological community make it really, really significant. And it's low elevation, so you get a lot more woodland species, whereas the ranges to the east and over in the Pilliga, they're not as diverse and they're not as productive. So the plains, the rich soil type surrounding the forest, it makes a really productive forest, so we get really high abundance of species and diversity. So one of the most significant things about the forest is its bat diversity. We recorded 16 species of bats within the forest, and of those there's probably three species of cave dependent species. We haven't actually found where there's caves there yet, but they must be there somewhere. And the bat abundance is really quite phenomenal. The bat abundance is second to none. I've not seen that sort of abundance anywhere. The last time we trapped in the forest, we had 246 bats in two nights in two harp traps. Or sorry, one night in two harp traps, which is really, really high. So woodland birds are really significant too. So species like turquoise parrot, barking owl, hooded robin, diamond firetail, speckled warbler, those sort of woodland birds that have declined a lot because we've lost so many of our woodlands. They're really important. And so that sort of pretty much covers all the importance of Laird State Forest, I would think. Yep.
So when this forest is made into the enormous proposed Maules Creek mine, they're starting now to clear the trees, where will all these critters go?
Well, that's the big thing, because we're going to see big declines. So here we're talking about clearing just about half of the forest. And all the proposed conservation measures, which are offset properties which the mines have purchased with the intention of managing them for conservation, they're supposed to be able to, within the life of the mine, they're supposed to be able to provide equivalent habitat, as in area and abundance of habitat, to be able to accommodate those species. But that's not going to happen. We're looking at significant declines, because the purchased properties are highly degraded, highly disturbed, so they're ex-farming land properties, and a lot of them as well are never going to provide habitat because they're the wrong communities, and they'll never provide potential habitat for some of the threatened species. So yeah, it's all very simplistic. The impact assessment talked about all the different measures that they're going to use to offset, but in reality it's not going to happen. We're going to see declines. It's a bit like clearing half of a town or a city and expecting the other half to move in with the neighbours. It's just not going to happen. And within the life of the mine, which is sort of 20 to 27 years maximum, there's not going to be regeneration of equivalent habitats in any of those offset properties.
So it seems like there are claims that these offset properties are going to be a good place for those species to prosper, and yet that's not the case. What's going on here?
Well, it's just a very simplistic assumption that we have available to big developments like the coal mines that we're talking about now, we have available to them to be able to purchase properties as offsets that supposedly will provide that habitat, but it doesn't. Very rarely do offsets work. I've been involved with one case where artificial habitat has been successful, but I think there's a lot of people starting to dispute offsets. Martine Marin and Phil Gibbons recently put together papers about the scientific credibility of offsets, and we need to be looking much more closely. It's a case of sort of having your cake and eat it too, where the mines are allowed to go ahead on the understanding that they can adequately conserve and compensate, but the reality is it just doesn't stack up scientifically. We just don't have the science to be able to say that it does work. And yeah, they put in monitoring programs and that, but it's too late then. Like with all these species, they're planning on doing monitoring, but once the forest is cleared and they suddenly realise that, hey, some of those offset properties aren't going to provide potential habitat, then it's too late because the forest is gone. So yeah, the underlying problem is that we're getting too many ecologists and consultants moving into areas that are outside of their expertise, where they're out of their depth, and they really don't know what suitable habitat is for a lot of these species, and they make very simplistic assumptions, and yeah, there, all these reports go off to departments and people sitting behind desks, and the numbers look really good. They're talking about conserving, you know, much greater areas of habitat as compared to the areas cleared. But the bottom line is that it's not similar habitat. It's not like for like. It's not equivalent in any way. But it still gets them past the approval. So just by sheer numbers of what looks good on a piece of paper.
You went to visit the Whitehaven office today in Boggabri with some requests to see an offset review paper. What is that paper? Why do you want to see it, and why can't you see it?
Yeah, we went into Whitehaven's office to ask them if we could see the independent review of the offsets. So when these mines were approved, they were approved with lots and lots of conditions that the mines had to go out and purchase additional lands and demonstrate how they were actually going to achieve a conservation outcome. So that was due on the 30th of December. That was Tony Burke's condition of approval to tick all the boxes of the conditions. And it was delivered to SOPAC, the Federal Environment Department, for their review. And it was prepared by a mines consultant who had actually been approved by the Federal Environment Department. And in that, we had hoped that we would see a truly independent review of the offsets. Whether it is or not, we still don't know, because we haven't seen it. But the issues that we have with the offsets is that a lot of the vegetation mapping of the offsets, in fact, the bulk of it, so we're talking about probably two-thirds to three-quarters of it, have been mapped incorrectly. So what they've claimed to be critically endangered ecological community is actually Stringybark Open Forest. What we had hoped was that the independent review would have gone out into the field and looked at those same areas that we've looked at, that we've actually had two other botanists go and look at. And just this week we've had another botanist go and map that vegetation and confirm the same results, that the vegetation is not as it has been mapped by the original consultant for the mines. Yeah, we had hoped that the independent review would have gone out into the field and looked at those and come up with a finding the same as we have. We wanted to see that independent review to be able to determine if that was going to be a document that we could then go to the government and say that here's proof that you actually got, the mines actually got the vegetation mapping wrong. And that would mean that the whole approvals in the first place were actually based on false and misleading information. So if we could have got it would have been really good, but the mines seem to have dug in. There is a requirement that it be made public. It was supposed to be put on the mines website for public exhibition. It's nearly a month now and we haven't seen it. We're really concerned that that they're going to delay us getting to see this particular document, and we actually have an appeal date, the end of appeal date, so the court challenge that was handed down on the 20th of December, which we actually lost, we're still able to appeal that decision up until about the 7th of February. So if we could have seen the independent review, that might have given us grounds to be able to go back and say, yes, well, here's the evidence to show that the approvals were false in the first place. But we still don't know, and it appears as though, from what the mines told us today, they're not going to give it to us. Yes, they seem to be digging in. Unfortunately, the approval that Tony Burke issued didn't have a due date on when the independent review of the offsets had to be made public. And it just states that it has to be made public. So at some stage, when it suits the mines, I guess they're going to finally get round to making it public, but that's not much good to us. So yeah, we're contacting Greg Hunt and trying to go down other avenues now to be able to get access to that independent review. Hopefully in the next few days somehow we get to see it.
So what's your message for Greg Hunt, Phil Sparks?
Ah, well, there's lots of messages for Greg Hunt. It's this whole approval process has exposed just how weak the whole Environment Protection Biodiversity Conservation Act is and how easy it is to manipulate it. So we have a lot of nationally protected matters of national significance in the endangered, critically endangered ecological community and threatened species, that he's personally responsible for the conservation of those. And it just seems that any consultant can put together a report that stacks the figures and misconstrues the description of the vegetation communities to enable mines to be approved that shouldn't be, particularly in this case where we're talking about a large public forest of over 7,000 hectares that's conserving a hell of a lot of species. You'd think that it'd be just a sacrosanct, no-brainer, that you just wouldn't entertain the thought at all of clearing such a forest. But the approval processes and all the loopholes that developers and consultants can exploit, it's amazing just how little protection we really do have. The message to Greg Hunt is that they need to tighten the EPBC Act up even more, and certainly don't hand powers to New South Wales, well, to the states in general, which is what they're proposing, because it's only going to make the problem even worse if the states have the powers to be able to do what they like without federal review as well. It's just a really shonky process that it's the average Joe Blow in the street just doesn't comprehend or get to understand. We think we're under this false impression that we have all this environmental protection legislation out there working to ensure that things are going to be conserved, but at the end of the day it just doesn't add up. It's all open to corruption and misconstruing in lots of different ways, and it's just going undetected.
So you've been a battler on this campaign and others for many years now. What sort of inequalities do you draw on to keep going?
Inequalities do I draw on?
Yeah, where do you get your strength in this?
Sorry?
Where do you get your strength from in this?
Oh, gosh, well, I spend a lot of time in the bush, a lot of time, and I understand and I appreciate I have a connection with wildlife that comes from many, many years, and I just can't stand it. I just hate to see what I'm seeing. It's just wrong that we don't have decent protection. So that's what motivates me, and I just keep going whatever I can. There's always more loopholes out there to exploit. We've sort of got the shotgun approach where we're shooting off in lots of different directions, hoping that one will pay off. Yeah, you don't know which one's going to actually deliver an outcome that'll protect the forest, but in the meantime, you just keep trying.
Well, on this show, we're calling for people all over Australia to join this campaign to save the Leard State Forest and add power to your voice, Phil. And we'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for all those hours and hours of unpaid effort and all the skill and attention you've put into trying to save those critters and ecosystems. Thank you, Phil Sparks.